This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. This is The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Our flagship station, AM 740, Zoomer Radio, a 50,000-watt blowtorch of a station that reaches far down into the United States. And, of course, we have around 25 U.S. affiliates and counting. So those listening online at www.zoomerradio.ca and talkzone.com, and of course far and wide via the podcast, welcome one and all. If you dig the radio show, you might also want to check out The Conspiracy Show on television, seasons 1 and 2, continuing to air in high rotation, as they say on the radio, on Vision TV across Canada. So you want to check out your local listings to find out where Vision is on the dial in your area. And Season 3 coming this fall, 2014. Earlier this week, just found out, The Conspiracy Show, again, the television program, debuted on Destination America in the United States. So we finally have that foothold in the U.S., The Conspiracy Show television program on Destination America. So we're pretty darn excited about that. Before we get started with the main menu, I want to draw your attention to a very exciting event that's coming down the pipe right here in Toronto. For those of you, and I know you are legion, fans of the legendary investigative journalist, world-famous author, Jim Mars. Jim is coming to Toronto for a very intimate evening presented by our dear friends, Patrick and Kadena, at Conspiracy Culture. Sunday, June 22nd. His first time in Toronto, and let's face it, you know, it could be his last. So you don't want to miss it. It's at the Bloor Cinema, and if you go on to conspiracyculture.com, and you'll see all the details there, how to get tickets. Act fast. You don't want this one to slide by you. Jim Mars. And here's the cool thing. After the Bloor Cinema, and this is Sunday, June 22nd in the afternoon, after you hear Jim speak, and I'll be emceeing, and maybe doing a little Q&A of my own on stage, and then you'll get a chance to ask Jim Mars some questions. After that, this is the cool part. We go across the street to the Pauper Pub, and you get to hoist a few and talk shop with the one and only Jim Mars, author of Rule by Secrecy, Alien Agenda, A Crossfire, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, The Trillion-Dollar Conspiracy, Our Occulted History, Above Top Secret, the one and only Jim Mars. All right. That's just a little bit of an hors d'oeuvre for you. Let's tuck into the main menu, shall we? Tonight, over the next hour, we're going to talk about something most of us have witnessed or wondered about. But nothing, I mean, the silence is deafening The silence is deafening in the mainstream media. It's that huge pink elephant in the room. In fact, if you've wondered about this particular phenomenon, this strange occurrence overhead, hint, hint, and then you call the newsroom of your favorite radio or TV station or the newspaper to find out, hey, what's going on up there? What are these strange crisscrossing patterns I see in the sky? They'll ignore you. They'll laugh at you. They might even hang up the phone. If you call the Ministry of Transportation here in Canada or the Airport Authority and say, hey, what are those planes spraying up there? They'll likely plead total ignorance. So why all the silence about these strange white trails? We're told they're condensation trails, contrails. This is the normal crystallization of water vapor as it comes out of these jet airliners. Nothing to worry about. But many of us have suspected for some time that these are not normal contrails or condensation trails. They are chemtrails. The deliberate aerosol spraying. And there's considerable documentation to suggest that the culprits in the spraying, or at least the vehicles involved, we're talking about military transport planes, the C-130 Hercules in some instances. And these chemtrails are believed to contain things like aluminum oxide particulates, strontium, barium. All of these things have a very strong link to heart disease, Alzheimer's. Soil samples and water samples in places like Mount Shasta in California. The aluminum particles in the soil are off the charts. Some say the spraying is part of a joint scientific military program called geoengineering. Some say it's a last-ditch effort to stave off the effects of global warming by deflecting the sun's rays back up into the outer atmosphere. Others have posited that this geoengineering program or aerosol spraying is part of a depopulation agenda. Some suggest the chemtrails work in conjunction with something called HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project up in the Copper Valley in Alaska. Well, my guest tonight is the author of a brand new book. In fact, it's so new the ink is barely dry, and it's arrived perhaps just in time to shed some very important light on this issue. Let me crib from the book. We are entering a space age, but not the kind President Kennedy originally envisioned. This space age is replacing resource wars and redefines planet Earth as a battle space in accordance with the military doctrine of full spectrum dominance. This book that I'm speaking of examines how chemtrails and ionospheric heaters like the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, HARP, in Alaska, services a full spectrum dominance. This revolution in military affairs needs an atmospheric medium to assure wireless access to the bodies and brains of everyone, anyone on planet Earth, from heat-seeking missiles to a form of mind control. How sinister are these technologies? Are we being prepared for a global village lockdown? The recent release of NSA records have reminded Americans that eyes in the sky are tracking us as supercomputers record the phone calls, emails, internet posts, and even the brain frequencies of millions. Elana Freeland's startling book sifts through the confusion surrounding chemtrails versus contrails and how extreme weather is being geoengineered to enrich disaster capitalists and intimidate nations. A deconstruction of Bernard J. Eastland's HARP patent points to other covert agendas, such as global smart grid infrastructure that enables access to every body and brain on Earth, a transhumanist future that erases lines between human and machine, and nanobiological hybrids armed with microprocessors that infest and harm human bodies. Over the years, Ilana Freeland has been a Waldorf school pioneer, storyteller, lecturer, writer. She's written for alternative publications all her adult life to give suppressed issues a voice. For the past two decades, she's ghostwritten several books on diverse topics and edited the stories of survivors of MKUltra and ritual abuse. She's the author of her own Sub Rosa America series, a fictional history of the United States since John F. Kennedy's assassination. In 1996, she was awarded a Master of Arts in Great Books from St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, including honors for her thesis on historiography. She now lives in Olympia, Washington, and has just finished writing Chemtrails, Harp, and the Full Spectrum Dominance of Planet Earth for Feral House Books, available for purchase June 10th of this year on Amazon or in local bookstores. And it's a great pleasure to welcome back Ilana Freeland to The Conspiracy Show. Ilana, how are you?
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Let's do some quick definitions here. First of all, explain what HARP is exactly. What does it do? Where is it?
Well, I'm sure that your readers have heard that the installation in Gakona, Alaska is closing down. And perhaps they think that now we're done with this terrible technology that is actually Tesla's darkest dream. But it's not true. And in the introduction to the book, I make it very clear that the term HARP must refer to a global systemic technology that is in place and being added to daily. This is the beginning of a technology far beyond the resource wars and the final oil, the oil wars. This is the what I think will be remembered as the age of technology, the age of electromagnetic technology. And HARP is just phenomenal in the agendas that it serves.
And so the idea, you have this array of these radio antennas that are blasting the ionosphere, and some have contended that it can be used to create earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes. It can move the jet stream around. It can cause droughts. It can cause you name it, just about any weather phenomenon. It can create that weather. It can manufacture the weather. So
yes.
How does or how do these HARP installations, because as you say, it's gone global. I mean, maybe they shut the one down in Alaska, but there's, you know, how many more out there that we don't know about. But how does HARP work in conjunction with the aerosol spraying of, say, aluminum oxide and barium and strontium? How do the two work in conjunction? Can we get into that a little bit? We'll come up on a break here in a minute, but we'll start the conversation now and continue it after. How do they work in conjunction?
It's really important to understand how it works. What you're talking about, the microwave heaters, they're, of course, striking the ionosphere high above the Earth. And in the ionosphere, there are many ions of electrons loose. And the heat, to heat the ionosphere, is to stimulate the production of more electrons. And then this stimulation done by the microwave heaters, the ionospheric heaters, is then steered for the variety of agendas. And you've mentioned a few. You've mentioned the weather agenda, and that is crucial to weather warfare, economic warfare, the globalization of all nations, bringing them under submission to various networks of like the Bilderberg, the Council on Foreign Relations.
Let me just jump in here, Ilana. We're going to take a time out. We'll come back and continue to delve into HARP and chemtrails. Ilana Freeland, Chemtrails, HARP, and the Full Spectrum Dominance of Planet Earth, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. Welcome back. Yelena Freeland is with us in her brand new book, Chemtrails, Harp, and the Full Spectrum Dominance of Planet Earth. It'll be available to book buyers on June the 10th, so you're getting a sneak preview here. And obviously, we're just going to be able to skim the surface of this very important issue. So, Yelena, before the break, you were discussing or explaining how HARP and chemtrails, how they work in conjunction.
Right. And if I could just repeat a little bit, as the heaters, the heaters up in, say, for example, in Gakona, Alaska, by the way, a new HARP is going in down at the Arecibo Observatory down in Puerto Rico. They go up, they balloon out the ionosphere, the heat forces the ionosphere to bloom, and up. It drags the atmosphere up along with our jet stream. And then down the magnetic lines of force come the now very, very activated and additional particles. These accelerating particles come down, down, down. And now another heater comes in that can strike it in a way that Tom Bearden talked about, interferometry. And this is an interfering beam. And by having two beams from another installation, two other installations, nothing to do with the Gakona shifting of the microwaves up to the ionosphere, then they can steer it dually. And this is how they will utilize fronts of weather. They can create hurricanes. They can create tornadoes. There's a way to create cold fronts, warm fronts, and this was, of course, promised in the document Owning the Weather in 2025, the military document that is among the appendices of the book, and we are there.
Yeah, they're ahead of schedule. They're way ahead of schedule, Yelena.
Well, they always do that, though. They'll put it years in advance, or they'll use words like will, would, could, and when it's already happening. I mean, I envision science as being approximately, maybe I'm being too conservative, 50 years in advance of what we're being told. So it's not just about the weather, though, and that's what I try to do in this book, is I perceive this book to be a primer for everybody who are well-versed in chemtrails or have been wondering about them or just coming to observe something strange in the skies overhead and noticing how their lungs aren't working as well as they used to. It's for people to get just the bare bones of this technology that is crucial. And when these particles are coming down, now to ionize the atmosphere for all the wireless transmissions that it's needed, you know, one of which, is, of course, is drones, now come the chemtrails. And these are filled with conductive metal particulates, and the polymers are separate, but yes, there are polymers as well. The metal particulates are very important because they can stimulate the accelerated particles to accelerate even more. And so this making our atmosphere, ionizing it and keeping it ionized, because of the force of gravity, these particles will fall, so they have to be renewed daily. These particles can be used to steer the weather, to increase the wind factor of a hurricane or a tornado, and they can also be used for communications. And, of course, the military is very fond of what they call C4, and that's command, control, communications, and computers. So now everyone's been sold a cell phone. Everyone's accustomed to Wi-Fi as being something that is a birthright, and yet these towers and our radio stations and all of the power lines and all of this that we're supposed to grow accustomed to, while we're now breathing these metal particulates that are conductive and they are in our lungs, they're in our bloodstreams, they're in our bodies, now we are part of the experiment of this ionized atmosphere. And that's crucial for people to understand. This, I go through the book and look at it as mostly experimental. And you'll see if you study different phases of this, it's been going since about 1995, this latest thrust of the chemtrails, HARP, dump and pump, I call it, is really about finding out how people will survive in an ionized atmosphere. This is crucial to them. Not that they care that some of us die or that we're ill, because, of course, it makes the medical industry rich. That's not a concern. But they do, I'm sure that many hospital and clinic records are being scanned and hacked in order to see what's going on with people now that they're living in an ionized atmosphere. And it has to be re-ionized all the time.
Well, you know, if you ask anyone out there, when was the last time you saw a completely blue sky? I mean, it just doesn't exist. I remember as a kid, I mean, there were days there was not a cloud in the sky. And today, in 2014, for the last, as you say, last 15 years, maybe 20 years, there's never a day where there isn't some kind of strange, it starts out as maybe a thin white line and then it gradually expands, and pretty soon you've got this very unnatural looking haze floating yeah. around up there. I remember I was up in Northern California, and I was interviewing Rosalind Peterson, who's a chemtrail watcher. And we sat there and watched as a plane went by and left this thin ribbon of, it was a chemtrail. And then we watched. She said, "Now wait." And he said, "At the end of the interview, let's see what happens to it." And sure enough, 2 or 3 hours later, it was like half of the visible sky was covered in this strange haze. I guess ostensibly it's blocking out the rays of the sun. But what is it? What are they doing? Are they in California, for example? Are they creating droughts? Are they trying to drive farmers off the land? What are they doing?
Well, I mean, yes. Again, experimentation is ongoing. Of course, Dane Wigington has done a superb job of speaking in everywhere about the aluminum factor going on and ruining the soil and the trees in Northern California. He lives at Mount Shasta. It may seem strange to people that our own country would be destroying our own country and people, but the military mind is dedicated to a full spectrum dominance. And so many things can only be done at home. They can't, even though NATO has been completely compromised for many years, they still can't go into other people's countries and do what they can do here. I mean, an example would be Hurricane Katrina, the super hurricane back east. These are done in our own country. And as I point out in the book, and in California it would be the same, disaster capitalism is now being supported so that when you have disaster in your experiment to see what happens, you can then bring in contracts, rich contracts for Halliburton and all the military-industrial complex. They're not concerned on that level. And I think it's important for people to realize that we have to think on a different level than a decent human kindness kind of American who thinks that, of course, we are here to respect each other. We've all been trained and conditioned to do that in our schooling, et cetera. But our leaders are, meanwhile, preparing for the future. a future that they themselves will write.
Well, you mentioned the disaster capitalists that are creating the disease in order to offer the cure. And one of the things that I understand, disabuse me if I'm incorrect here, but as I recall, when you put all that aluminum into the soil, it alkalizes the soil. Then you've got these Monsanto and other companies that are creating these seeds and these plants that thrive in that kind of soil, but everyone else's crops are failing miserably. They create the disease, and here's our cure. Buy our seeds because our seeds will thrive in this type of soil.
Yes, and the aluminum is particularly attractive to them, even more so than the barium. Barium is for a different purpose. The aluminum is attractive because of its surface area. It has four times the amount of surface area in a nanoparticulate size than any other metal. And so it's important for the conductivity of the atmosphere, and they're willing to pay the price for soil and the loss of trees because now they'll have Monsanto have an aluminum-resistant fertilizer and seed and blah, blah, blah. So this is, it's kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul, but it is how the military industrial mindset works. And now that the economy has been lowered, and that has been very purposefully done in that slow boiling frog way, then now they want to turn disaster capitalism into a moneymaker. And I don't know if you know this, but weather derivatives on Wall Street are big bucks. And we're talking insider trading, the same thing that Enron got caught doing. In fact, weather derivatives started at Enron, ironically. So this whole scheme to keep a money flow going at the expense of the earth, at the expense of people, is how this is going to work. And this is, to me, this is not an overnight thing that's going to end. It's the same as in the history chapter where I point out, with the help of Dr. Rosalie Bertel and Nick Begich and Gene Manning in their wonderful chronology of all the things that have been done without our knowing are being done to us, has been going on since the end of World War II. I mean, this is all Cold War stuff. Cold War's over, but now we've got, a chem war. And I think that what Dane has realized, which I'm really grateful, I saw a headline that indicated this on his site, that this is an assault. This is an assault on the earth and her peoples, on the atmosphere, on the troposphere, on the magnetosphere, on the ionosphere. I mean, it's mind-boggling given that we are a part of the cosmos. And if something goes wrong, and I underline the word if, then what will happen to our moon, our sun? I mean, beyond our oceans, beyond our rivers and our land. This is Tesla's TNT, his magnifying transmitter, or as it used to be called, a Tesla howitzer. This is Star Wars. It has it is bearing fruit. And down here, the fruit is very bad
for us. We'll take a time out, come back, and continue our conversation. We'll find out how chemtrails, working in conjunction with HAARP, can be used as a weapon of mind control. Ilana Freeland is with us, and her brand new book is entitled Chemtrails, HAARP, and the Full Spectrum Dominance of Planet Earth. Right here on The Conspiracy Show, my name is Richard Serrett. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week on the program, the second hour, we have our good friend Victor Vigiani from Zealand News Network, and we'll be welcoming a civil rights lawyer, Daniel Sheehan, who will describe his efforts to end the truth embargo as it relates to the UFO ET issue. And Daniel has been involved in some of the, you know, the landmark cases throughout the last 40 years, including the Pentagon Papers and Watergate, Iran-Contra, you name it, the Karen Silkwood case. So that'll be exciting, Daniel Sheehan. And in the first hour, we'll be talking about online privacy. There's a contradiction in terms, right? Like jumbo shrimp and military intelligence, the old George Carlin routine. Mark Weinstein will be with us to discuss how to safeguard your online privacy, or whether the proverbial horse has already left the barn. I think we might know the answer to that one. Right now we're discussing HARP and chemtrails. And Ilana Freeland is with us. Her brand new book is entitled Chemtrails, HARP, and the Full Spectrum Dominance of Planet Earth. I want to get back to HARP and how it relates to mind control. And my understanding is that that HARP, these HARP-like installations, which are everywhere, not everywhere, but they're, it's not just, you know, the one in Alaska, as you pointed out, Ilana. They can generate radio radio frequencies up to 435 megahertz, which is somewhat similar to sort of the background of human consciousness, which also operates in that range, does it not?
Well, the way I think of it, I'm sure you're right, but the way I think of it is that HARP is particularly good at long-wave ELFs, extra-low frequency. And extra-low frequency acts very powerfully on biofields, not just the human mind, but on our entire biofields. And that is some of the research, and it was through his research that Clifford Carnicum has done. Life set me up very nicely in Santa Fe, where I lived for 5 years, and I was friends with Clifford and his wife, Carol. And I became involved in Clifford's studies of these pathogens that are being piggybacked onto the polymers that are floating down with the chemtrails. So you have the barium, the strontium, the aluminum, and other things. I just talked to a woman the other day who said that her friend was telling her about high cesium in her blood. So Clifford added to that a wonderful, and I devote a whole chapter to Morgellons, as I'm sure you're familiar with the term.
Absolutely,
but
yes.
Now I understand how it works and how that is tied to the mind control piece. And to put it very briefly, as we breathe in these particulates, some of them are actual nanofibers created in laboratories that are Clifford now and then calls hybrids. They are very organic, but they are inorganic, and they have been programmed because they have sensors in them on a nanoscale. Just remember that we're talking submicron. They have sensors. They have microprocessors in them. So what I'm saying is we have all breathed these, not just the people that have the terrible Morgellon symptoms. They are in our bodies, and they can be communicated with if someone chose to do that. So this is how I see that HARP is going to connect with mind control. We're talking frequencies, and these frequencies are ELF frequencies. They're coming in long waves, long pulses. They're even pulses. And as Dr. Robert O. Becker so brilliantly pointed out, cyclotronic resonance is how to gain the human mind. And this is probably my greatest concern, Richard. Yes, the weather and all that, it's more than big boys with toys at this point. But this possibility that our nervous systems are being plugged in via these microprocessors on these hybrid fibers is very, very, well, scary. What can I say? When I first started doing this, I would just sit in awe and stare out the window. Now I feel, and in the book, what I did is I laid out some things that people can do to help themselves, mainly their immune system.
Okay, let's pick up on that point when we come back, Elana. This is important. We'll do that. On the other side, Elana Freeland is with us as we discuss HAARP and chemtrails right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay a while. All right, Elana Freeland stays with us until the top of the hour. Now, Elana, before we get into some of the remedies here and how we can defend ourselves against this full-spectrum dominance and the effects of HAARP and chemtrails, I just want to spend a few more moments talking about how this mind control can work. Now, are we talking about, I mean, you can't focus this on one individual or one neighborhood, or can you? I mean, is it more of a just sort of a general malaise, like to control the entire population, to dumb us down, to make us docile, pain compliance, these sorts of things?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I do tend to think of it as a frequency-based technology that could easily broadcast with all the cell towers, the old Gwen towers, the NEXRADs on radio station towers, could easily broadcast a violence frequency into a city neighborhood, and that wouldn't be the entire city, just a certain neighborhood, when everyone just goes nuts. All right, that could happen. Because the point is, Richard, that the atmosphere has to stay ionized for all the C4, command, control, communications, computer. And computer would be cyber warfare, right? So yes, you can do that for a neighborhood. All right, maybe a ghetto or something like that. Now, as far as individual could work that way, I suppose, with a dedicated satellite and towers that you could triangulate with. I mean, that's already being done. It's mostly that HAARP chemtrails creates the atmosphere in which anything can be done for military industrial agendas. That's how I read it. But the Morgellons creature, that adds a new dimension. Because we have them in us. We have breathed them in. They are very, very tiny, but they are alive. And I, in the chapter on Morgellons, it's a crucial chapter, and it's not a happy camper, easy answer chapter, but Clifford Carnicom has done all the research to nail all this down, and he has had 180-some military alphabet soup agencies hitting his site over and over and over again to see what he's coming up with. I see that there is no way. I have it in me. I saw them in my blood, in my blood slide. These little guys love iron, and they love hemoglobin. So they distort our blood cells, but as I say in the book, to live our lifestyle now, not for convenience, not for safety, not for a great career, but with our immune system at the very top of our list, the very top, where we are taking good care of our bodies. And it's, to me, I guess I'm one of those people that I look at a glass and I don't see that it's half empty. I see that it's half full. I've always been like that. And this is forcing us to really become responsible for ourselves and not look to the great white doctor in the medical establishment, not to look for a drug, a happy drug that's going to take away our woes. This is our responsibility. And I am full of goodwill toward this, because do I think I can stop this? No, I can't. And it is a vast experiment. It's like cell phones are a vast experiment where we're putting transmitters up to our brain. I won't go into that now. But this is also a vast experiment. What happens when various microorganisms that are produced in labs, artificial microorganisms, are inserted into the human biofield? What happens? And that's what's being studied. And I'm sure they're taking notes madly as they hack into people's medical records and see what's going on.
Well, short of living 24/7 in a Faraday cage, because we are swimming in an electronic smog, and there's no escaping it. If you live in a city, you probably know, you're within 100 meters of a cell tower wherever you are. And we have wireless internet in the public square, in all of the Starbucks. You cannot escape it. So what do you suggest that we do, Elena?
Well, what I'm doing, I suppose, is what I'd suggest. I don't own a cell phone. I always tell people that I'm not that important. I wear a diode. I order diodes for my family from a certain place on the web where it didn't look like it was a placebo. I have a friend who sends me power stones. I surround my computer with anything and everything. And I watch my lungs because that's where if I could be inappropriate, also the feces. You can smell metals in feces. And then to think, well, what did I eat yesterday? And to really take responsibility to lower those things which I feel weaken my immune system. And for me, it has to do with dairy, sugar, four-legged meat, guys. I don't eat any of those. And when I do, my lungs suffer right away. And so I then will ameliorate that the following day with my consciousness. I will make conscious decisions to help my poor little lungs out because I can't eliminate it. It's in the air. This has got to be one of the most powerful experiments going, and that Americans, more than Europeans, are oblivious to what is going on over our heads and what is, you can even see it in the sky, Richard. You can see it when it's dropping. It's like a veil. And you know those are the particulates coming down. And yet, we still insist it's a conspiracy theory. We still wait for some astrophysicist or plasma physicist or president to come forward and say, yes, this is what we're doing. Well, that's not going to happen.
I saw some interesting...
That's why I took the bull by the horns and wrote the book. I'm not a plasma physicist, but I'm a very good researcher. And I tried to do my best to give people the tools and the keys by which they know what's going on and they can take responsibility.
I saw some interesting documentation which showed the admissions to hospital emergency rooms in Los Angeles County and Orange County, several documents, and the spike in admissions for things like high blood pressure and some sort of a cardiac event after a period of heavy spraying. These chemtrails, so
yes.
It's quite remarkable. And obviously, people will say things like, "Well, if the end game here is depopulation, they're not doing a very good job of it." But I don't think the end game is to kill everybody off. It's to keep us perpetually sick, chronically ill, with upper respiratory ailments and dependent on pharmaceuticals.
Well, it's to run open field experiments. That's the way they'd talk about it. This is open field experiment. And no, they don't want to kill all of us. They might like it if the weakest of us sort of drop dead, and the rest of us, they will study to see, gee, how did they make it? I mean, that's really the sort of deadened consciousness that is running our science now. I'm sorry to say, which is why, of course, you know, I quote scientists in this work, but I try to quote the ones that seem to be actually thinking and responsible for their humanity.
Can this HARP be used to make people more docile? For example, you know, there was something that was supposed to happen in Washington over the weekend. It was called Operation American Spring, and they were hoping to get somewhere between 10 and 30 million Americans marching on Washington, demanding the resignation of all of the leadership, including the White House and the congressional leaders and so forth. And they got several dozen people. There seems to be, despite what's going on out there everywhere, a lack of moral outrage. Is that due to HARP?
Oh, you can do that easily with frequency. And look at Ukraine. Look what happened to them. Was that frequency? I mean, that's always my first question now.
Excellent point. And what about dumbing us down? Can that be achieved through HARP?
Well, think about what our cells are going through right now in the assault they're undergoing, and our immune system, our brain cells. These things are going through the blood-brain barrier. They're so tiny. The aluminum is going through our blood-brain barrier. What can this possibly do but dumb us down? I mean, just on that alone, not thinking of any nifty little frequency that could make us stupid. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's why I don't my politics have changed. I'm not looking at things like I used to of different political movements and this must be because of so-and-so, Putin, and this and that. No, I'm thinking the technology. And when I listen to leaders talking and what they say to Obama or what they say to their people, I can often hear that they're saying something to us like a warning, but not able to speak, because, of course, it's very dangerous to speak of these things.
Well, I think you're right. I'm long past the point of looking at the world or politics in terms of, you know, Democrat versus Republican, liberal versus conservative up here in Canada, right wing versus left wing. It's really that it's a charade. It's that's for public consumption. That's the window dressing. There is no left wing or right wing.
Brzezinski told us years ago, technocracy. This is a technocracy, and technology is being used on us. And it's just a matter of waking up and deciding what we're going to do, not wringing our hands and being afraid, but it's a reality. What is our next step?
You call it a global village lockdown. I guess that's the end game. And if global village lockdown is, you know, 12 midnight, how close are we to midnight?
Well, I think it's being done with a slow boiling frog way. And you mentioned the sort of people who are not doing anything and not showing up. I mean, we may already be there, and it's just a matter of degree. Just a matter of degree. I mean, they want people to work, and they don't want people to go to school, obviously, because it's absolutely prohibitive now except for the elite classes. So I'm imagining we're already in it, and for me, life is still pretty good. I'm still able to think. I'm able to write. I'm able to go out and see people. And I think we need to count our blessings and meanwhile, care.
All right. Well, Ilana, we appreciate it, you spending some time with us, and congratulations on the book, just in time. Chemtrails, HARP, and the Full
Thank
Spectrum
you.
Dominance of Planet Earth. Good speaking with you again.
All right. Bye, Richard.
Bye-bye. Ilana Freeland. All right. My website, your portal to The Conspiracy Show. Don't forget to subscribe. We're closing in on the 500 mark, and then I'll start publishing the weekly email, richardserrett.com. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett, and as always, follow the truth. And thanks for inviting me into your home and your head. Thanks for your ears and your voices. Dear friends, wherever you are, I pray you are safe, dry, warm, and well-fed. Let me remind you that the great Jim Mars, investigative reporter, New York Times best-selling author of Rule by Secrecy, Our Occulted History, Crossfire, Alien Agenda, etc., will be making his very first appearance in Toronto in June 22nd. And you don't want to miss this extremely rare opportunity to send here Jim Mars in person and meet him. Patrick and Kadena of Conspiracy Culture are presenting, and I'll be emceeing and perhaps interviewing Jim on stage at the Bloor Cinema, Sunday, June 22nd. Get all the info at conspiracyculture.com. And don't delay with this. Get your tickets. Don't miss out. And it's the first and possibly the last time Jim Mars will be coming to Toronto. I was in Fort Worth, Texas a few years ago. We were filming some episodes of The Conspiracy Show, the TV program, now available on Destination America, part of the Discovery Channel family. Anyway, Jim invited me over to his home, and so I walk into his office where he's working on all those great books, and the first thing I see, he's got a holster and a six-shooter hanging from his coat tree. I look at that, and he says, "Welcome to Texas." In all honesty, he's one of my favorite people, and he speaks his mind. He does it with courage and conviction. And that's something all of us to aim for. You know, speaking your mind can get you in a lot of trouble these days. I've been crossed off on Christmas card lists myself or uninvited to parties because of some of my views. Global warming, for instance. I don't believe in anthropogenic or man-made global warming, but there are climate scientists out there, too, who don't buy into it, and they're taking a lot of heat. No pun intended. I'm just reading here in the London Daily Mail about one such, a climate scientist who's been gagged by green zealots. Groundbreaking climate research that was controversially covered up suggests the rate that greenhouse gases are heating the earth has been significantly exaggerated, again, according to the Mail. Renowned Swedish scientist Professor Lennart Bengtsson of Reading University was at the center of an international row last week when his study was rejected by a leading science journal after it was said to be harmful and have a negative impact. The rejection sparked accusation that scientists had crossed an important line by censoring findings that were not helpful to their views. Professor Bengtsson further claims one of the world's most recognized science publications also decided not to use his research findings because he said they were considered to be uninteresting. Professor Bengtsson's critical paper was co-authored with four colleagues. It focused on the growing gap between real temperatures and predictions made by computers. In a recent key report, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change stated that the climate sensitivity, the amount the world will warm each time carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere double, was between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees Celsius. According to Professor Bengtsson, his paper, it is more likely to be 1.2 to 2.7. And the implications of the difference are huge. If the planet is warming half as fast as previously thought in response to emissions, many assumptions behind targets for reducing emissions and green energy subsidies are wrong. The subsidies, in turn, have led to significant increases in consumers' power bills. We can appreciate that here in the province of Ontario. Last week, it was revealed Environmental Research Letters had rejected his paper because it would be seized on by climate skeptics in the media. Well, my guest for the next hour likewise believes it's not man-made global warming we need to be concerning ourselves with. It's global cooling. He warns a new ice age may already be upon us. He cites as evidence an 11,500-year cycle related to Earth's rotational axis, in which ice ages lasting from 1,000 to 5,000 years occur like clockwork. He suggests that extremes in weather patterns, such as the recent record-breaking series of tornadoes, could be signs of this impending change. Robert Felix, is a former architect who became interested in the Ice Age cycle back in 1991. He spent the next 8.5 years full-time researching and writing about the coming Ice Age. He then concentrated on spreading the word. His book, Not by Fire but by Ice, has achieved international acclaim with readers around the world. And today, Robert continues his research and is more firmly convinced than ever that the next Ice Age could begin any day. In fact, he believes it has already begun. Robert Felix, welcome once again to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Fine, Richard. How are you?
Well, I'm doing okay, despite, you know, all the doom and gloom out there. But, you know, I'm not frightened by global warming. I don't believe it. Never have from the beginning. And, I mean, I remember back in the early 70s when everyone was talking about global cooling.
Yes.
And but you say that it's not – I mean, ice age is – explain how ice age is, an ice age happens, because it's not about the temperature. It's about the precipitation, correct?
Exactly, exactly. They don't call it a cold age. They call it an ice age. And, of course, before I go in there, I mean, you've been able to see what has been happening with the Great Lakes this past winter. That doesn't look very much like global warming to me. But, no, as we head into an ice age, we have what are called snow blitzes, where it snows more and more and more. And you reach the point where the snow does not melt in the summer, and so it's not that these huge glaciers grind out of the north. I know a lot of people in the United States have that kind of mindset. They think that those ice sheets that used to cover Canada, that they'll come back and that they will creep down out of the north. And of course, people think it will take thousands of years. But we're looking at snow blitzes, and we're looking at ice ages that begin in less than 20 years. And this was, scientists discovered this back in the 1990s, and they didn't really believe it. They were drilling deep cores into the ice in central Greenland. They drilled down like 2 miles deep, where they could pull up these cores of ice that had formed as much as 250,000 years ago. And as they looked at those cores of ice and at the everything that's in the cores, the dust and the ash and whatever they see, is they found that every ice age in the last 250,000 years had begun in less than 20 years. And we're talking, I mean, going from periods of warmth such as today into full-blown glacial severity in less than 20 years.
And so one day...
Right. I fear that we're headed in that direction right now.
So, in other words, what happens is we're here situated in Toronto, Ontario, perched on the, mm-hmm. the north shore of Lake Ontario. So one day it starts to snow... in, let's say, late March and into April, as we had snow right into April this year up here. And
yes.
It just and what happens is once we're in the midst of an ice age, it just keeps snowing and we don't get that melt. And then along comes May and the snow's still on the ground, and then it keeps snowing and it won't stop.
And the other part, even without that, the part that worries me even more is that I fear that we'll be fighting in the streets for food long before we're covered with ice. And the reason I say that is, for instance, the Little Ice Age, which occurred in the 1600s, essentially. But
when the canals of Venice froze over.
Yes, when Venice froze over, they didn't have thermometers back then, so they couldn't, they can't go back and look that way when they look at the history. But they do know that farmers in the Alps, farmers were petitioning their local governments for tax relief because their fields and their pastures were covered with ice. So, but anyway, what happened, for instance, in England? During that period, England didn't get covered in ice, but what happened is that the rainy period lasted about 5 weeks longer in the spring, So farmers weren't able to plant until 5 weeks too late. And then rainy season came back 5 weeks earlier in the fall, so they weren't able to harvest. And this happened year after year. I mean, you've heard of the potato famine. My mother's family actually moved from Ireland because of that to Canada because of that potato famine. That was during the Dalton minimum as opposed to the Maunder minimum. But anyway, because the planting season started 5 weeks later than normal and the harvesting ended, literally millions of people died of starvation. And that's what I look at now. And, you know, I look at governments around the world that are putting all of these phony taxes on carbon and on coal, on the things that create our energy. And just when we're going to need that energy the most is when we're not going to have that energy. They're destroying our energy.
Well,
as far as I'm concerned,
we already have a perilously short growing season up here north of the 49th, as you're well aware.
Yes.
And so it would only take a couple of weeks, you know, shortening that by a few extra weeks on either end of the growing season. As you say, it would create massive food shortages. But people will look to the drought that California has endured the last several years and might ask you, well, where then is this, you know, ice age for Californians? Where is this, you know, precipitation? Why aren't they experiencing it?
It's obviously not there right now. Now, I'll go to an English climatologist here, is Hubert H. Lamb, H.H. Lamb. He wrote a book about the Little Ice Age. In fact, he studied it. He wrote several such books. And in one of them, I've read his books, but in one of them he describes that as you go into an ice age, you are looking at extremes in both directions. And he talked about areas as we entered the last ice age, areas of the world that had the worst droughts in 500 years, and then they turned around and had the worst snowstorms in 300 years. And this happened in the same location, same year.
As we head into a break, Robert, let me just throw this out there,
yes.
And we can continue this conversation in a few moments. But these strange weather patterns that the global warming alarmists are attributing to global warming are, in fact, perhaps the initial stages of a coming ice age.
I think they are.
All right. Not by fire, but by ice. Robert Felix, back here on The Conspiracy Show, right after this, stand pat. And welcome back. Move over global warming. Hello, Ice Age. Robert Felix is with us, the author of Not by Fire, But by Ice, the website iceagenow.com. Explain, Robert, the connection between sunspots and the weather or the climate here on planet Earth.
You bet I can. Also, it's iceagenow.info, so it's in both locations now.
Terrific.
Well, actually, there was an article that just came out on May 15th. A solar physicist at the National Solar Observatory in Tucson, he thinks that we are headed into a grand minimum right now. And his name is Mark Giampapa. But anyway, it does have to do with the sunspots. During the Little Ice Age, sunspots declined until for about 50 years there were no sunspots. Now, there has been a big argument in the scientific circles that some scientists say that this makes no difference. Other scientists say it does. And I think that we're seeing the proof that it does, because the Little Ice Age did happen when those sunspots were dropped to zero. And right now, sunspot activity is the lowest that it has been in at least 100 years. And I think it's even lower than that, because NASA, when they are studying sunspots, they now have fantastic telescopes where they can really see sunspots that nobody could see back in the 1600s. And I think if they were looking at the sun with the same quality of telescope as we used to have in the 1600s, they would see that we are indeed headed into what's known as a Maunder minimum. Now, there's a David Hathaway. He's a solar physicist at NASA at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. And he says, we're at the sunspot maximum of cycle 24. It's the smallest sunspot cycle in 100 years. So this is official from NASA that it is the smallest sunspot cycle in 100 years. I think it's even smaller because I think they're recording sunspots that shouldn't even be there or shouldn't even be counted.
I'm just looking at your website, Robert, and it says here on your website, iceagenow.com and .info, that by 2016, the sun could become spotless. Okay, in 2 years, the sun could become spotless and remain that way for decades. So, and this is similar to the sunspot activity in the 17th century, which coincided with this period of cooling called the Little Ice Age. But what is the connection between why do little dots on the surface of the sun, why does that affect our climate so much?
Well, they've been trying to figure it out because the sunspots are actually cooler than the rest of the sun. But there's still more to be found, but they're beginning to think that the sunspots affect the UV rays, which we haven't even been measuring and looking at as part of a cooling part. So there's still more to be learned, but it apparently has to do with that. I've talked with a couple of astrophysicists. There's an astrophysicist in London, Piers Corbin, I visited London a few years ago, and I was lucky enough to meet Piers. Actually, he and his wife had myself and my wife over for dinner one night, which I greatly appreciated. But he says that we are headed into a little ice age right now, based on his astrophysical studies of the sun. And there's another one another astrophysicist that I was lucky enough to meet is Dr. Habibulo Abdusamatov. He's a Russian astrophysicist, and he also says that we are headed into a little ice age. Now, some of them say mini ice age, but he says that we're headed into a drastic period of cooling. And Dr. Abdusamatov is not... It's pretty impressive, I think, the fact that he's an astrophysicist. But he's not just any old astrophysicist. He also happens to be head of Russia's portion of the International Space Station. So, I mean, we're talking about very, very legitimate science here that our politicians are trying to sweep under the rug and trying to, they've found themselves a cash cow. And as far as I'm concerned, that's what it's all about.
Once it starts snowing in earnest and won't stop, I mean, tell me the kind of accumulation we'd be looking at. Let's say, you're on Manhattan Island and it starts to snow. Can you give me some visuals here to help me understand what an ice age would look like living in New York City?
Well, eventually, on the cover of my book, I have an artist rendition of a city with tall, 100-story skyscrapers that are completely buried under the ice. And I've had some geologists in New York complain to me because they said the ice was actually three times deeper than that. In a lot of Canada was covered with 2 miles thick of ice. I know in Seattle, in the United States, Seattle was covered with 4,000 feet of ice, 4,000 feet straight up, so you're talking four-fifths of a mile.
Obviously, no way.
Areas will happen sooner. Go ahead.
Obviously, no way to survive in that type of climate, obviously, right?
No, I don't think there is. A few minutes ago you mentioned Fort Worth, that you had been there.
Yes.
And I just came back from Austin, Texas last night.
Ah.
because I've been down there looking at the Texas Hill Country. I'm looking for places that I think are going to be safer. Right now, I do live in the Seattle area, and it's getting, you know, right now it's fine. But if I'm right, then this thing is going to come on in a hurry. The way it's going to come on, I think, is during the Little Ice Age, is volcanic activity increased tremendously. And during the Big Ice Age, of course, volcanic activity increased even more than that. So what I see happening is that is how this thing would happen very quickly, is that if we have a huge volcanic explosion, or if we have lots of little ones at the same time, then we're going to be looking at the, you know, cooler skies. And the other half of that equation, and I think eventually this will be my contribution. So far, science has been ignoring underwater volcanic activity. And I think that is what has been heating the oceans, is underwater volcanic activity. I think that's what's been heating the Arctic Ocean, is underwater volcanic activity. So what you have is you have warming oceans, meaning you've got more moisture rising into the sky, and it's rising into a sky that has been cooled by the above-water volcanoes. So that is what I see as the recipe for an ice age.
Can you give us sort of the latitude, the degrees latitude, roughly where on Earth the effects will be felt of the ice age, and below which there would be a safe haven?
Well, it'll be hard to describe. On my website, on iceagenow.info, if you scroll down and look on the right hand side, I've got a link for ice age maps. But talking about the United States and Canada, is I've got a line on there that shows, but essentially the ice covered, came down out of Canada and covered Seattle, and then it moved over to like Spokane and almost up to the Canadian border in Idaho, where there was a tongue of ice that moved down out of Canada and dammed up the Clark Fork River. Then it followed the Missouri River. On the north side of the Missouri River, there was a cliff of ice about 15 stories tall. But on the south side of the Missouri River, you could have lived there, even during the Ice Age. Well, then it followed the Missouri. It covered most of Wisconsin. It covered all of New England, almost all of New York. And as I look at the map here in front of me, it covered Toronto. So eventually that's going to happen again.
Right. So if you're in the Carolinas, you'll be fine.
Yep. What happened? Well, for instance, I mentioned that Seattle was covered with 4,000 feet of ice straight up. But if you went 150 miles south of Seattle, temperatures were only about 7 degrees colder than they are right now. They tell that because scientists can look at the kind of plants that grew in the area at the time. So, okay, 7 degrees colder, that's quite a bit colder, but you can survive it. Over near you, the climate of Chicago essentially moved to Georgia. And if you've been keeping track of the weather this last year, I mean, Atlanta, Georgia was shut down.
Yes.
for days. It was so cold there and icy and snowy. So, you know, again, I think I'm seeing the beginnings of it right now.
Well, there's been rumblings sort of online and in certain circles that certain government agencies, particularly in the United States, have been pulling up stakes and sort of surreptitiously moving. And I'm wondering if, you know, this is in anticipation of some cataclysmic event like an ice age. Are you tracking any of that? Are you noticing that government agencies are sort of quietly going about their business in anticipation of a little ice age or a grand ice age?
You know, unfortunately, I don't believe it very much at all that comes out of my government. So I'm not aware of that, but it wouldn't surprise me. I just don't. with all of this talk about global warming and rising sea levels, I think it's silly. And sea levels have been rising for 11,500 years. Sea levels, I mean, that's what happens when you end an ice age. During the last ice age, sea levels were 370 feet lower than they are right now. The Bering Strait between Alaska and Siberia, the Bering Strait is only 270 feet deep. So during the last ice age, it was above water. Our ancestors could have walked here from Siberia. So sea levels have been rising every single year for 11,500 years. This is nothing new, except one thing is new, is that and you don't hear about this. You can find it on my website if you Google it. But in 2011 and 2012, satellite measurements show that sea levels actually declined just by millimeters, but they actually declined during those 2 years. Hmm. Because when you think about it, I mean, that's where all the moisture comes from to build up those ice sheets that cover Canada. It has to come from somewhere.
Right, right.
That's where it comes from. For instance, on the east coast of the United States, Florida was twice as big as it is now because sea levels were further out. New Jersey, sea levels were 100 miles further east than they are now. That's going to happen again.
Well, the global warming alarmists, when they talk about evidence to buttress their case that we are in the midst of global warming, they talk about the retreating glaciers. But to my mind, glacial activity has more to do with precipitation than temperature. So what is happening with the glaciers?
Some of them are receding, but not most of them. You know, the Himalayas, we were hearing a few years ago that they were all going to be melted by 2035. It turns out that was based on a study by one person who wasn't even a scientist, who wasn't even published. It turns out that the glaciers in the Himalayas right now are growing. K2, the glaciers are growing on K2. The glaciers are growing on Mount Everest. Glaciers on, I can't remember the full name of it, something Parbat, but glaciers are growing in the Himalayas. I've got several different articles about that on the website. Glaciers are growing right now in the United States, and you don't hear about that, but on Mount Shasta in California, there are several glaciers. I think there's five. But anyway, all five of those glaciers have been growing for the last 50 years, and nobody talks about it. In Washington State, the Mount St. Helens, if you remember, that erupted, 1981.
It's starting to make rumblings again, too.
Go ahead.
It's starting to make some rumblings again. They're wondering whether it might be ready to erupt. Listen, we'll take a time out, Robert, come back and continue to discuss the coming ice age. Heck, not coming. We may already be in the beginning, the midst of another grand ice age. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. Hey, welcome back. Just a couple of quick notes. If you go to the website, richardserrett.com, and once you've subscribed and registered, that'll give you access to some special members-only areas of the website, including our past show archive. But here's a new addition. When you go to the past shows, you can now listen to the program from that particular date. But you've got to register to get access to it. RichardSerrett.com, and on the left-hand corner, just scroll down and you'll say subscribe and register for member-only content. And we're gradually adding a listen or the audio component so you can listen to that program. It's going to take us a while, you know, to get them all up there. But I would say going back the last several months, you can now listen to those programs, those previous shows. The other thing I want to mention is coming up on the program in a couple of weeks, Cheryl K. Chumley is the author of Police State USA, How Orwell's Nightmare is Becoming Our Reality. Cheryl Chumley on The Conspiracy Show. Right now, Robert Felix stays with us, the author of Not by Fire but by Ice, and he's warning that we may already be in the midst of another ice age. How long will this ice age last, Robert?
Well, it'll probably last around 5,000 years. So So we certainly won't see the end of it. You know, just before the break there, I was talking about Mount St. Helens.
Yes.
When Mount St. Helens erupted, there was there were a lot of ice fields, you know, and glaciers on top of Mount St. Helens. And so when it erupted, they all rushed, they melted and rushed down the Toodle River in a mishmash of mud and slurry and trees and bulldozers and whatever was in the way. Well, a glacier started forming again on Mount St. Helens, and that glacier, it's in the crater, it's called Crater Glacier, that glacier is now bigger than it was in 1981. So it started from zero and is now bigger than it was then. So that's so much for melting glaciers. Mm. In Antarctica, you know, the news, you've probably seen all the news in the last 2 weeks about all of this melting and everything that's going on. And it is deceiving. It is deceptive. It is not true. I mean, the fact, when you read the article again, make sure to notice that they're talking about West Antarctica. They're talking about the Antarctic Peninsula. Well, that peninsula obviously is sticking out into the ocean, and it is warmed by the warmer seas. But when you go inland, the Antarctic glacier is growing thicker and has been growing thicker for the last, well, I guess 50 years at least. So it's kind of like when they talk about this, it's kind of like if you would look at the map of the United States and the whole thing were covered with ice, and or the ice was melting in Oregon but was growing thicker everywhere else, you wouldn't say that the ice is melting. But that's what they're doing now, is they're talking about a comparatively small part of Antarctica where the ice is indeed melting, but everywhere else it's growing thicker. And Antarctic sea ice, the ice in the ocean around Antarctica, has been breaking new records every single month for years. So to me, it just drives me nuts to see this deceptive information being put out there.
When the ice age comes, we would be looking at, I'm guessing, because there would be some advance warning. As you say, it takes about 20 years. But we're going to be looking at a massive migration from northern climes to the southern United States, Mexico, etc. Give me an idea of the numbers of the people affected that would have to basically pack up the U-Haul and head south.
Well, again, I'm afraid that the lack of food will put a stop to that. But what I would anticipate that if that happens, you're looking at essentially a collapse of civilization the way we know it. And I think you'd be seeing states passing laws that wouldn't let anybody migrate south into their state. You'd see Mexico closing their borders.
And then there's, a switch. There's a switch.
There's a switch. And they would have to for their own survival, and I think you'll even see individual towns that have their own vigilantes, and I think there'll be lots of fighting. I really do, unless Canadians are really mean. During Genghis Khan swept out of the north during as we entered the Little Ice Age, and he was able to conquer much of the world, but. Right now, I don't think that you have the people who would have the stomach to do that sort of thing. But again, I'm saying food, because the Canadian grain fields, you know, you won't be growing there. The United States grain fields, some of them won't be growing, and so many other kinds of plants won't be making it. I think it'll be food. I don't sell food on my website, but I keep telling people you've got to have a supply of food.
All right, we'll take a time out, come back, and to continue our conversation, dire as it may be, with Robert Felix till the top of the hour, The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. We are here with Robert Felix, the author of Not by Fire, But by Ice. He's warming. We may already be in the early stages of an ice age, and the website is iceagenow.info and iceagenow.com. Robert, are you good to take some calls?
Sure.
All right. our board op, our new fellow in there, Damien, doing yeoman's duty, doing a great job. But before we – can we take Rudy's call? Are we good to take Rudy from Toronto? Rudy, are you there?
Hello.
Hi. Good evening. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Richard. And I'd like to ask your guest, Robert, that if we are starting to experience an ice age, then why are opossums moving into Toronto, into Canada? Animals that normally live in the southern states, they are now being spotted in Toronto. Do they not know that it's getting colder?
Good question, Rudy.
Hi, Rudy. You know, I guess I can't exactly answer that. I think that if they were coming in because they thought it was getting warmer, then after this this cold winter with the Great Lakes freezing over the way they have, the worst in 3 or 4 decades, I'll bet they're not moving into Winnipeg. What didn't in Winnipeg this year there were thousands of frozen water lines and sewer lines that were frozen more than 6 feet deep. So,
I could add to that.
I can't answer it.
I might add something to that. And this part of Ontario where we are is referred to as the Carolinian Ontario, or the forests here sometimes are referred to as Carolinian forests. So there is. I don't think anything unusual. In fact, I know I remember as a child, and I'm a half century now. We had opossums in Ontario, so they've been around. I don't think that they're not certainly native to this area, but I don't think it's unusual to have opossums up here.
Well, you know, I can talk about a different kind of animal because I grew up in Vermont, so not too far away from you. And as I was growing up, there were absolutely no moose in Vermont, none whatsoever. And in the last 30 years, moose have been moving back. They've been moving south from Canada into Vermont. And they're sure of it because there have been more than 1,000 moose automobile accidents and some people have been killed. So for sure. Now, I, of course, wanted to blame that on global cooling. But it turns out I contacted the wildlife management offices in Vermont, and it turned out that 200 years ago, when people moved into Vermont, the farmers, they were sheep farmers, and they cleared most of the trees. Well, now there's no sheep farming in Vermont, and trees have been growing back. And so the moose are growing back there not because of the weather, but because there's more trees and they can hide. So, with that in mind, I can't make a quick answer about the possums. There may be a totally different explanation.
Well, we did have my sister-in-law, or rather my sister and brother-in-law, had a possum take residence in their garage this past winter, and they found it frozen stiff as a board just a couple of months ago.
So it met its
demise thanks to perhaps global cooling. Mark is in Ajax this morning, Ajax, Ontario. Mark, welcome to the Conspiracy Show.
Hello, Richard.
Hi there.
Yeah, it's Mike, actually.
Mike, sorry.
Gentlemen, is it possible these HAARP installations and these chemtrails could be used in a good sense and they could start steering the weather the other way?
We were talking earlier, Robert, about chemtrails and HAARP and whether they're being used to manufacture the weather. Is it possible that this is a bit of a misdirection? They're not actually trying to forestall global warming, but they are in fact trying to forestall global cooling. Is there a connection with chemtrails, I guess, is what I'm asking?
Hi, Mike. I guess I don't go there. I haven't studied chemtrails at all, not a bit. So I can't go there on that. The reason I haven't studied them is I think that humans are being arrogant to think that they could control the weather in either direction.
Is there anything that – Mike, thanks for the call in Ajax. Is there anything that could be done to forestall it? I'm guessing not.
I don't think so, no. Because this has happened time and time and time again. It has to do with something called precession of the equinox. It's a total naturally cycle. I'll try to explain that a little if I can. Is that
our Earth is tilted. It doesn't rotate in a totally north and south, but it's tilted at about 23.5 degrees. So right now, if you could put a stick all the way through the Earth, through our axis of rotation, and point it toward the heavens, it would point toward the North Star, toward Polaris. But that axis of rotation slowly rotates, so that it takes about 23,000 years. And so 11,500 years from now, that stick will be pointing toward the star Vega, and then another 11,500 years from then, it'll be pointing back toward Polaris again. And ice ages seem to correlate almost perfectly with that precession of the equinoxes. So I don't think, that's way bigger than anything that humans could affect.
Again, with the dire predictions here, but what percentage of the population of the human family will survive this?
I'm going to sound like such a doom and gloomer, but I don't think it'll be a very big percentage. What was it back 75,000 years ago when Toba erupted in Sumatra? And I think that eruption, that killed so many people, they said it created a bottleneck in the DNA. And they figured that maybe there were only 8,000 people who survived that worldwide. So I don't know. It's just hard to know. But I think we're going to lose a lot more people than anybody's prepared for.
But with that said,
if you could survive the first year, then I think you're going to make it.
And how would one go about preparing for such an eventuality? I mean, obviously, you want to move to warmer climes, and you're talking about the foothills of Texas.
But you don't have to go that far south. South of where the line was before, I think would do it.
Right.
And have that supply of food, but don't tell anybody you have that supply of food, because you're going to have to be prepared to protect it. What I'm hoping, is that if our governments could understand what's going on, that they could start experimenting with different kinds of plants. A Kusti rye, for instance, will grow in much lower temperatures. So if I'd like to see some money devoted, instead of studying all of these bad things that happen because of global warming, I'd love to see research on how you could grow food in a cooler climate. It's there. The ability is there. We do it, but not on a massive scale.
Durum wheat, for example. Durum wheat, winter wheat. A few years ago, they were talking about putting a gene from a flounder, which of course exists in very, very cold water, putting a gene from a flounder into wheat. So I know a lot of us balk at GMOs, but there's an example where it might actually come in handy. There'll be no infrastructure to speak of. There'll be no power grids. But you're saying if we can survive that first year, before we get to that point, you mentioned, the lack of food. That's going to obviously precipitate some clashes around the world. We could get to the point where we don't even see the ice age because we'll have a nuclear winter.
We could, and this the little ice age cycle. This cycle correlates with the fall of many empires. It correlates with the fall of the Grecian Empire, because they have battles, wars over grain, and maybe nobody realized that that's what they were doing, is going into an ice age. But the Grecian Empire collapsed as they headed into an ice age, a little ice age. The Roman Empire collapsed as they headed into a little ice age. Genghis Khan rushed out of the north, swept out of the north as we're heading into a little ice age. The Sumerian Empire disappeared as we headed into a little ice age. The Egyptians. So, the history is there that this happens, and if we could just, what do they say? If you don't study history, you're bound to repeat it. And I'd love to see us
studying the history of some of those collapses, not just looking at the wars, but looking at why they were having those wars.
And you, as you say, this happens like clockwork. So, I mean, is it possible, though, that in terms of the clock, you could be off by 50, 100, 200 years?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But I, you know, I'm seeing more and more indications that what I see, what I think is coming. And the other part, of course, is I think it's going to be associated with a magnetic reversal. And we haven't talked about that much, but in my studies, I have found that magnetic reversals occur on our planet approximately every 11,500 years. And the last magnetic reversal, the Gothenburg magnetic reversal, was almost exactly 11,500 years ago. So with that tying, and when that reversal comes, that's when volcanic activity increases dramatically. So I think that, you know, that'll be a part of it too. Now, when I started writing the book, scientists said, oh, it takes 5,000 years for a magnetic reversal to occur, and there won't be one for 20,000 years, whatever, you know, nobody knew. But the British Geological Survey came out a couple of years ago and admitted that we could be heading for a magnetic reversal right now. So it all, you know, it's all beginning to tie together in my mind.
Does that have any relationship to, for example, the fact that you know, the magnetic north is sort of drifting? It's now no longer within Canadian borders. It's now somewhere in Russia.
I think it could. During previous magnetic reversals, is what happens. Of course, for people who don't know what I'm talking about, is all of a sudden your compasses point toward Antarctica instead of toward the Arctic. But during previous magnetic reversals is what happened is sometimes it fluctuated. The North Pole would move partway south, and then it would go back north again. Then it would move partway south again, so it would fluctuate. And so, you know, what we're seeing now, I don't know if it's something that's going to go back again or if it's going to continue on moving south. But that is the other thing that happens during magnetic reversals is magnetic field strength goes down to about 15% of normal before it finally reverses.
Well, we'll have to save that for another right. Occasion. But Robert, I really appreciate you spending some time with us again. The website is iceagenow.com and .info, not by fire but ice. Appreciate it, Robert.
Thank you, Richard.
All right, Robert Felix. Thanks to Damien and Tim Spreen, as always, back next week with another program. Hope you'll be along for that. And in the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.